Welcome to the Way of the Womb podcast. My name is Beck, I'm your host, and I'm a trauma-informed holistic birthing doula, womb worker, and earth lover. I am here to support you and all womb owners, whether that's through your monthly cycles and navigating the everyday, or whether that's to support your journey through the rite of passage of pregnancy and birth. My passion is to support souls to come home to themselves, so you can connect back to your innate power, your intuition, and the wisdom of your body, so you can feel empowered and live your truth. On this platform, we will be discussing periods, pregnancy, plant medicine, birth, trauma, mental health, spirituality, earth to body connection, and everything in between. This is a place for conscious souls to gather, so that together we can heal, thrive, and live authentically, unapologetically as ourselves. This is the Way of the Womb podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome back to The Way of the Womb, and I have the lovely Hazra with me today. And we were just talking about when it was that we met, and we actually met in person at Conscious Birthing Training in July of this year, 2022. And Hazra came on to talk about breastfeeding and breastfeeding awareness and support for mothers, and I was helping alongside Kate Woods to facilitate the birthkeeper training for seedling doulas. So it was so beautiful, and Hazra's passion and knowledge in and around breastfeeding was just amazing, with having two little girls of her own. So I've invited her on today, and I'm very excited for her to be here. So thank you for coming on, Hazra.
Oh, thank you, Beck. Yes, we were just reminiscing about sunnier times, and it was really lovely to get to meet you. So I remember that we first had a sort of a call during my doula training with Kate, and then following that I met you at the Brighton training, and it was really nice to have a chat. It was quite like an intimate group, and yeah, we had this sort of like just talking through. The thing is, you're trying to sort of like feed or fit rather everything about feeding into a couple of hours, and you're just opening more and more doors. But it's just really nice when you're probably what our conversation will be like today, where it sort of flows, goes
absolutely
into another,
scratching the surface. Because I know, what is it, breastfeeding training, you can do like 3 years of breastfeeding training, can't you? Or I know this, you can become a counselor or a support, or obviously it's lactation consultant and everything, but there's so much to it. So today we're literally scratching the surface, but I would love to hand over to Hazra. And yeah, first of all, just ask really what it's like breastfeeding in the UK as a brown Muslim woman, but also just in general in the UK, because I remember, as we've just said before we started recording, hearing you explain the breastfeeding statistics in the UK and being like sickened by the statistics of women that actually get support and exclusively breastfeed past a certain amount of months. So I would love for you to dive in.
Yeah, so we were talking about the infant feeding survey, and I had a little look at it just before, because every time I say these statistics, I think, oh, these are from 2010. And I always have to remind myself that things will have changed since then. Mm-hmm. And the reason we haven't had a newer one is because the funding was stopped for the infant feeding survey. And I read a little bit, you know, a couple of lines that was just saying that now local areas just have to collect on a voluntary basis information about breastfeeding. And, you know, word voluntary probably say a lot. And, you know, you look at, for example, the stats that come out of maternity units anyway, and you see what they provide, you know, what information they provide us with. It's just so upsetting that we don't have anything recent, you know, specifically for the, you know, nationally telling us what's going on. But in 2010, initiation of feeding was 80%. So at birth, that would have been the babes that would have latched, you know, in the earlier days. And then exclusive breastfeeding at 6 weeks was 24%. So that's a huge drop. And you're talking about, this is exclusive, so that's not talking about combi feeding, but okay, still, you know, if we're looking at the WHO recommendations and what we should be doing, what we should be doing is probably the wrong way of phrasing it, but what would benefit babies and mothers, you know, breastfeeding, they say exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months, that's what the WHO recommends, and then some amount of breast milk up until 2 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's just really hard because if you look at Amy Brown, a lot of the books that she writes, she's a really trusted source. I would definitely go and read, she's got loads of books, would go and read a lot of her stuff to help you, you know, get a bit more clued up on this, if you're interested in it. But it's just that there is this expectation. I want to go back to the error I made, which is what we should be doing. And so we're telling mums, you should be breastfeeding, but the support and the help just isn't there. Mm. And whether that's on a, from sort of like maternity units and the help that they can provide, and, you know, say for example how well versed and how well trained they are, so all of it, health professionals, for example, going back to GPs, health visitors, midwives, everyone has a different level of training, and it might be dependent on sort of what they feel passionate about or what they have been paid to do and help do, because training does cost money sometimes. And, you know, the maternity depends on what their unit might have sent them on. So that's, you know, and then their own personal experience, because remember, a lot of the work, the workforce is female. So, you know, or may identify as female. And what you're going to be looking at there then is people who will naturally bring in, just like they do with birth, bring in their own biases and what's happened to them. And that's just a small portion of it. And then you're thinking about families. How did families feed? How was I fed? Did I see my mother breastfeed? No.
And even like, what is everyone's beliefs around their own body and how comfortable they are with their own body and everything? It comes, there's so much to it, isn't it, that you just don't think about when you're looking on surface level, about how that midwife, depending on her own experience, could. You know, majority of midwives do encourage and support as much as they can, but, you know, to, we hear so often, just give them formula of like this brushing off, what, maybe because they don't have time, maybe because of their own experiences or whatever it is. And that can be so detrimental to mothers when they're in that vulnerable space of just giving birth and, you know, trying to navigate and establish a routine or even a latch with baby, which every baby is so different.
Yeah.
It's like a minefield.
Yeah, and the statistic which really shocked you was that at 6 months, 1% of babes were being exclusively breastfed. And yeah, that was in 2010.
I can't believe that was the statistic. I'm just, there are literally no words, because how is it that in this day and age, when we have the science to back it up, are women not being supported and encouraged to feed their babies up until 6 months, when we know the benefits that it can give to mother and children? And it's like, and also like how much more cost effective it is, and like a whole other range of things. Like, that's so sad. It's so upsetting, not to mention, like, you know, it's not just nourishment as in food and water that baby is receiving, but that relationship, that building, that bonding that's happening as well. It makes me so sad.
You're so right. And the first thing that you mentioned there about, you know, it being, I guess, the better thing in terms of health promotion for infants and mothers. And that's something that the government and I guess those who get the money into the areas that they need, that, you know, where the money needs to be, don't consider. Even for thinking about women going back to work and, you know, where, how helpful, or, you know, managers and the workplace is going to be to allow them to continue breastfeeding. I mean, if you think about someone who's come back and they've got really good breastfeeding support and they can express, they've got space to express, a space to put their pumped milk and all that kind of thing, and then you know, you're thinking about someone who hasn't been given that and how likely it might be that they get something like mastitis, then have more time off work, you know, and even in terms of the health that we were talking about earlier, before we started the call, about the, you know, the health of the baby, of course it's important, but there, it's a two-way thing, you know, feeding the baby. There are benefits for the mother as well. And, you know, a lot of, I just want to bring up weight as the first one, because I feel like there's this thing where weight gets put as the most important thing. Oh, if you breastfeed, you'll get back to your pre-pregnancy body or whatever, which infuriates me. That's, so if that's the reason you're doing it, then fine, that's for you. But that's not, you know, by health, we're talking about things like reducing, you know, the likelihood of things like breast and ovarian cancer and heart health. And I have to say that sometimes I do worry about my heart health with how many times I have to wake up during the night and all that kind of thing. I really feel like there is something to it there. You know, like imagine someone who's like sleep deprived and then you're going, the stress levels that come with being a parent. I'm sure there's something in it there.
Some magic in the body. And yeah. Oh my gosh. And so it's just, I mean, I don't know why I'm shocked, because of course that we promote breastfeeding as get back to your original weight as the be all and end all.
Yeah.
Like buy into this because you will get this from it. And why has it got to do with how we look? And it's so toxic, that culture. And as you said, if people are doing it for that reason, of course, that's absolutely, you know, that's everyone's own individual journey. But the fact that it can support women to have a lower chance of experiencing breast cancer and ovarian cancer and heart issues, it's just like, why aren't we being told this information? Women aren't being told this information when they're like, just give your baby formula.
Yeah, it's not the primary thing that people think, or any, you know, anyone who's promoting it thinks to say. It's all the other things. And as you were just saying about, I lost my train of thought, Beck. We're talking about mum.
What mum gets from baby. It's me going, I get that excited. So I'm like, I have to remember to say this, I have to remember to say that.
So we were talking about really messages that we hear and reasons as to why we might feed. And I feel like that's where the problem starts, because people say, you know, you might hear, say, for example, family saying, well, yes, that's the best thing. That's the most natural thing to do, is to feed your baby. But then as soon as, you know, your family might actually see that in action, it's kind of like the comments that you might receive, which is like, oh, you feeding that baby again? Or, oh, are you sure that baby should be feeding for that long, you know? And then starts to sow, you know, those seeds of doubt, which is, oh, do you think I'm making enough milk for the baby? And, you know, when you haven't been, so for example, I was just going to, you know, I wasn't breastfed. I received some amount of breast milk, but I, you know, it was mainly the time, I guess, when I was brought up in the 80s, it was formula fed, you know, most babies were formula fed. Yeah. And, you know, I think just looking at how partners can really help in those situations, it can be really hard when you're the one feeding the baby, but you're the only one who feels that you want to, and nobody else is supporting you in that, whether that's the practical things by getting you some food or whatever, water, or whether that's saying to you that you're doing an amazing thing. And, you know, if it's the emotional support rather than any, you know, I know it sometimes comes from a caring perspective, but at any point where you're struggling, it's like, well, don't worry, we've always got formula. That's not support. And that can come from GP, sadly, and from, you know, the health profession. And I was looking at postnatal depression and feeding are really sort of, they linked in quite a complex way, as these things are. But, you know, when a mother is experiencing postnatal depression and say goes to the GP saying, I'm feeling quite low, or say maybe talks to the family, one of the first things, well, if you stop breastfeeding, I'm sure you'd get more sleep, you know, that kind of rhetoric. Or, you know, you need to look after you, you need to stop putting out so much for the baby, you need to stop breastfeeding. But sometimes breastfeeding is the one thing that mum thinks that she's doing really well, or the one thing that's going really well. And as you mentioned before, you were talking about bonding with the baby, getting the chance to enjoy baby in that way. And there's calm and there's still, and it floods your body with oxytocin. What more would you want? And so, you know, and then, you know, being given those, you know, those messages, sometimes sadly doctors may, medication's a minefield when you're feeding and when you're pregnant, and you're being told, oh, you're taking this, you know, antidepressant, that's not compatible with breastfeeding. There are great resources out there. I'll mention the BFN, and you can join sort of, they've got a Facebook group, they've got sort of a website with fact sheets on there, and really, really good, you know, information about all pretty much, you know, most medications. And you can even email them if you're unsure. And there are generally are safe, you know, alternatives that you can take if they, you know, but generally, you know, you don't always have to stop something.
Yeah.
Just because you're feeding. And so that's, you know, definitely one to think about. So I know I went off on a tangent there, but I really felt like, yeah, that concentration on health and, you know, the baby being fed, sometimes it just gets a bit skewed and mixed up.
Yeah. And, you know, if we're talking about how to promote our own health and the mother is enjoying breastfeeding and wanting to continue and feeling really proud of herself for doing it, then surely we should be doing everything we can to ensure that that is held in the and celebrated for what it is, because actually that's contributing to better health for her and baby. So it's just like, God, I just, the more you go into it sometimes in and around the birth world, it's just like, in what, how many ways are we trying to disempower women and mothers and undermine them and think that we know better than what the mother knows? Just as you said, you know, if a mother comes and says, oh, you know, I'm really having difficulties with breastfeeding, someone saying, we'll just give them a bottle, is absolutely the opposite of helping. It's really disregarding and invalidating that her experience, and, you know, also not holding in respect and reverence how amazing it is that she's feeding her baby and that she's doing it, even though she's feeling these things or feeling, you know, I'm struggling or whatever it is. We should be doing everything we can to support mothers. And I know you know this, obviously, whoever's out there listening who isn't supporting, fuck off, basically. But yes, oh my gosh, it's, you know, God, there's so many loops women have to work through and go through, and to then fight up against family and friends is the last thing that we should be doing. Not to mention, you know, cultural differences and cultural things that women have to take into account. I know, as you said, mentioned a little bit before, and when we met in July, like your experience of breastfeeding, both of your girls, even with family and the outside world.
Yeah, sorry to stop you there, Beck. I was just going to say about about breastfeeding and family, and it's so tough for anyone of today's generation who's grown up formula fed and not seen breastfeeding happen, because that's where the first learning happens. Like, I'll see my little one getting her dolls and pretending to feed. I don't think I ever did that. But it's so lovely to see it, and you just think, oh gosh, she's learned something. I didn't tell her to do that. I didn't tell her how to hold her bunny and feed the bunny, but that's where the first learning happens. And it makes me so happy, because I feel like, so I don't think my grandma had many children. She had 10 children, well, 11 children who, I guess, where she would have had 14 or 15 children in total, but she had, and I have, yeah, 5 aunties and 5 uncles who are alive, I guess. And, you know, that's intense. Think about how many pregnancies she would have had. My milk dried up in pregnancy. She must have just been exhausted, but also there are hormones coursing through in pregnancy that for some women mean that they won't produce breast milk, or their breast, you know, milk supply will sort of peter off. And it just means that you're not seeing that cultural wisdom being passed down, you know, and being told, oh, if this happens, then do this. It's all very well and good, let's say, for example, my mother being supportive of breastfeeding, but when the first hurdle is when you go to voice a problem and the knowledge isn't there and the help isn't. So it's all well-meaning, for sure, you know. Let's say you have families that were getting to Christmas time and you're all around, you know, the table and someone's saying, oh, you know, I've got to do this. And someone said, well, but, you know, and the information that is coming through, sadly, can sometimes be mixed up with things that were maybe touted about 40, 50 years ago that just don't apply nowadays. Mm-hmm. And it can be really difficult to then you feel like not only are you feeding your baby, but you're then having to be like, okay, now I've got to go get the research. Get me Google the research so I make sure I'm saying the right thing and I can tell them, I can, you know, save this situation with research, which probably isn't going to always save the situation. Sometimes people just want to tell you what to do, but it's just very hard because you're kind of like, there are so many levels to it. It's not just feeding your baby. It's about telling everyone you're doing the right thing and then saying, oh, by the way, your information is wrong, but how do I say that so that uncle whoever isn't offended? And then I've got to make sure, as you mentioned earlier, it was sort of how the question started. It was about, you know, that I think you're angling at, like, you know, covering and how we might feed when people are around and, you know, let's say in public. It just adds so many layers. It's never just as simple as feeding your baby.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah. And having to not only feed your baby but then defend yourself. Yeah. Defend your baby and be like, this is why I'm doing it. And almost having to, you know, of course we don't have to validate or explain ourselves, but there is an element of wanting to be understood and heard. Mm-hmm. And important, especially when it comes to family. Yeah. So I can only imagine. So I've got so much respect to all the women who are doing it and just being like, I'm doing it because this is what I want to do and this is what's best for me, you know, and my baby.
Yeah, I work on the Association of Breastfeeding Mothers. There's the National Breastfeeding Helpline. So we as volunteers support that helpline and take calls. And, you know, many of the calls, yes, there are calls about practical things, but, you know, many of the calls are sort of support, emotional support, because, you know, someone say, well, I can't really speak to anyone in my family about this, or I don't have any friends who breastfeed, or people didn't, the other people in my NCT class didn't continue. And, you know, sometimes from, you know, partners, you know, that aren't necessarily supportive of, you know, why is it that the baby needs to be fed this much and why can't we do it a different way? And I guess it's, again, you know, for example, if you've your partner, either your husband or, you know, has grown up in a home where breastfeeding didn't happen, that understanding just isn't going to be there. So there, sometimes that comment might come across like, oh, you're still sitting there, you're still sitting down, or, like, you know, that kind of understanding just isn't there as to how often the baby might want to feed or want that connection with mum. And you mentioned bonding, and it's such a big one. And I feel like for a lot of people, they must feel a grief. I feel a grief from being formula fed and missing out on those cuddles with my mum. Mm-hmm. Essentially, I'm not saying I didn't get cuddles, but, you know, I feel a sadness for myself from that, because I feel like, you know, what connection did I miss out on with my mum because of that? My brother was born 11 months after me.
Oh, wow.
We're Irish twins. And I expect that was intense. And, you know, it's not said with any judgment on my mum. You know, that must have been, I can't imagine what that must have been like to have two babies in such close succession. But, you know, she had two cesarean sections, but so I was an emergency cesarean section. But funnily enough, I found my yellow book the other week, Beck. And guess what it said in it? It said failure to progress.
No.
Yeah, oh, so, you know, that was the reason for the emergency C-section. And so it's, you know, you just look at all of these things and you think, you know, breastfeeding was initiated, but you look at, for example, how easy or how quickly milk might have come in. So, you know, when we're talking, I'm going off on a tangent, we're going back to the birth world, because I guess I am so interested in why, when these interventions and things are pushed in maternity units, they might talk about the immediate effect. So, for example, all your baby's heart rate's gone down and we need to get baby out so baby can be out safely, but nobody's talking about what's going to happen 5 days down the line when your milk has, you know, there's delayed milk. You know, it's not that your baby milk wouldn't come through, but it might be delayed and you need to know that.
And is that due to is that something that's quite common then, that happens if someone's had quite a lot of intervention or potentially a traumatic birth, that can impact when the milk comes in?
Definitely. So it depends on what it is that's happened. And again, Amy Brown does some really good bits in her book Breastfeed Uncovered on this. And, you know, certain medications during birth for, you know, pain relief can mean that baby is more drowsy and less likely to latch to begin with. Yeah. And we know that that early latching, not necessarily within the hour like they push, but early latching for baby is better in terms of, you know, breastfeeding initiation, but then also how long that's going to continue. You know, and then there are other things that come into the mix. So, you know, for example, having a cesarean section or a belly birth, which I think I probably prefer to call it a belly birth. I mean, that's going to affect you in quite a few ways. You may have had other things in addition when you've had that. So you may have had the pain relief, but then there are lots of other things to think about psychologically. So are you going to be in a place immediately afterwards where you're going to feel like you've got all of the hormones flooding through you in the same way? Most likely not, just because of that natural hormone cascade, that cascade has sort of been, yeah, interfered with slightly. But it doesn't mean, I would like to add, I listened to a really good podcast, and I don't know if I can't remember, is it on the tip of my tongue, is it Sarah Buckley?
Yes.
That's one of the, so I listened to a podcast with her, and was it Rachel Reed, maybe The Midwife's Cauldron? Sorry, I'm like promoting all the podcasts on your podcast, but it was
absolutely promoting. Yeah.
She talked about like belly birth and how, you know, it's just about that awareness. There was a mum, I think she talked about, who had had two vaginal births and then had a belly birth. And the mum had said that, you know, with the belly birth, she did have the same hormones flooding through and that feeling of love, but it was just a bit delayed. And the way that she worked around it was having plenty of skin to skin in a calm environment and feeling, you know, just trying to create that loved up environment after the birth, which was what helped to get the milk supply going. So, you know, although I'm saying this, I don't want it to be that, oh, if you have to have anything or you decide to have pain relief or something like that, it means that, oh, your milk's not going to come through and that's the end of breastfeeding. No, definitely not. But it's about having that awareness. Are you making an informed choice? So, for example, for my first babe, I had the injection following the birth to have the placenta out. I didn't want that. And I didn't realize until maybe 6 months ago when I read Breastfeeding Uncovered that actually that injection can mean that it does affect breastfeeding initiation sometimes and can affect, you know, breastfeeding later on, how well, yeah, how you might carry it on. And I just thought, oh gosh, no one told me that. That was like literally a 10 second decision where she said to me, I think you're going to lose too much blood. Let's get out the pool and I'll give you the injection. And I appreciate that sometimes that's an emergency decision, but it wasn't an emergency decision in my case. And I would like to say,
unfortunately, the majority of the time it's not.
Exactly, exactly. And so I think that's the difficulty I have, is that are you telling people all of the things and what's going, you know, what that's going, we know that, you know, let's say for example, if you have planned, and this is a point that Amy Brown makes continually, is that it's about an individual choice. So yes, who says to breastfeed for 6 months, but if my target is I want to feed my baby for 3 months and I do it, I am more likely to be content, satisfied with the outcome, and, you know, for example, risks for postnatal depression go down. Whereas if I've come out and said I would love to feed my baby for 2 years and I manage a year, which is in my case was actually the case between my first and second, my milk didn't, then you do think about that and you do come back to that a little bit and think, oh, I'm, you know, yes, for some people breastfeeding for a year might have been what they wanted to do, but for some that might have, they might feel there that they didn't do what they wanted to do. Yeah. And that can then cause problems in terms of mood and, you know, what, how they feel overall about their journey. And that's really important. It's about how each person feels about their journey and you know, their own ideas. And I think I just wanted to add one final thing, which we haven't really mentioned, but with, you know, conscious birthing, there is such an emphasis on trauma-informed care. And for some people, they won't want to breastfeed at all. And it's going to be different depending on what your experiences are. You know, some people have experience things like, you know, assault and, you know, whether violence in different forms, and it may be that having a baby attached to their breast is the last thing that they would want. Yeah. And these are things that we have to keep in mind, and I don't necessarily think that maternity units are prepared for this, where I know this doesn't still happen, but, you know, essentially where a lot of women say that they are essentially roughhoused into baby onto the boob and, you know, that kind of thing, where it's almost like going a bit too enthusiastic in the other direction, where it's like, well, this is what we need to do and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
without getting any, again, consent or hearing what the mum wants and needs. And yeah, I think we all assume as well that our journey is going to be with breastfeeding is going to be automatically easy, because yes, naturally we can feed our babies in the majority of time, we can, but we get to have support with that if it's something we've never done before as well, or if, not even if it's something we've never done before, because it can be different baby to baby, absolutely. But just to have that support and that encouragement and the patience and time that sometimes a mum and a baby needs to establish that first feed or that first latch is massive. And it's just something that's not given the time in a hospital setting. And I really think that the lack of support, I'd love to hear what you think about this as well, like the lack of support that we're given, that is given to women and mothers, plays a massive part in why we are at 1% exclusive breastfeeding in the UK at 6 months.
Yeah, I think we've mentioned some of them, but the returning to work is probably one of a big reason that's given for women who stop between 4 and 6 months.
Okay.
And, you know, I mentioned that earlier, but you know, naturally we don't work in a way where we can say, oh, I'm just going to pop off and feed my baby for a minute. It just doesn't work like that. It would be so nice. And you know, I do feel that one thing possibly with COVID, for some workplaces, not all, where that idea of flexi working and working from home has probably really helped.
Yeah.
And you know, but that's obviously some workplaces, not, you can't work from home and with all workplaces, so it's not going to be, yeah, but Pregnant and Screwed, that you know, Jodie Briley or Briley, I'm pronouncing her name wrong, but she's doing some really good work on, you know, having mothers have the chance to ask for flexi time and hopefully be given it. And you know, something like that could really help. And you know, sadly in law, with what they have to provide for a mother when she returns to work, it's not necessarily all of the things that she needs. It's kind of just like a private space, which could, sadly, some employers translate that to the toilet or, you know, some an odd place like that where someone's likely to walk in on you, you know, and it's not a comfortable space. But then there are other things that we mentioned about, you know, support from partners and family and the comments that you get from people and a lot of people are nervous about feeding in public because you're worried about what people are going to say. We always have the odd story, don't we? Every five months or so, we've got a story in the news saying, oh, so-and-so was asked to stop feeding in public and so-and-so was asked to cover up. And it just goes across, you know, where women's bodies are so sexualized and viewed, breasts are viewed as this thing where, you know, it's just not seen as this is a way to feed a baby. It's like the mother is choosing to be, you know, look at her, like, you know, exposing herself, not, oh, the baby's so hungry. It's more, oh, look at her wanting to show off and get her nipples out or whatever. It's just so sad that, you know, in the news at the moment, there's been Jeremy Clarkson making some odd comments. Funnily enough, I just opened the page of Amy Brown and it was Jeremy Clarkson making some odd comments about breastfeeding that she'd written about in the book.
He loves to put his 2p in everywhere, doesn't he?
He basically compared breastfeeding to urinating. He's like, well,
what?
Yes, breastfeeding is natural, but so is urinating. And when this is the quality of information that we're getting given out to the masses, well, no wonder people aren't supporting breastfeeding, because people just think it's this really, you know, odd thing that you should be keeping behind closed doors. And, you know, don't come out, do it behind closed doors and don't show it to us, please.
Yes. And then because we don't see it and it's not shown to us, it's not normalised, and therefore we just perpetuate the story.
Exactly, you said it. It's this cycle that just goes, and that's why, you know, whoever chooses to feed and shows, whether it is to their children or their family or whatever it is, those subtle messages, even if, let's say, for example, your auntie doesn't agree with it, but your auntie's child might see it. You know, or whoever it is, and someone, you know, it has slow, you know, effects, and it changes things. I mean, I think for me, I really felt like people were breastfeeding in my family, and in, you know, from a Muslim sort of perspective, in Islam, it's actually, you know, written that you should breastfeed your child to the age of 2 years if you can. And that's kind of a right of the child to be breastfed. And, you know, there's a lot of logic to it there, but I didn't feel that that necessarily translated to what was happening for my family, because, you know, with second, third generation, migrants to the UK. And I guess I felt like, again, that sort of colonialism idea of what the white person does is the best had been taken on in so many aspects, whether that's to do with baby wearing, that, you know, it would have been natural to sleep with baby if you were living in India in the village. But here, if I told anyone I was doing that, it was kind of like, oh, really? Is that what you're doing? And, you know, for example, feeding a baby beyond 6 months. Yes, you can feed the baby, but there was almost like an idea of, oh, you need to strengthen her stomach now. You need to make sure that she's having some food. And you're like, well, you know, well, it's just not necessarily, things aren't done that way anymore. We don't need to feed the baby food immediately at 6 months. There are so many, I remember my cousins being fed a baby food lying down in the bouncer. So they would have been, you know, not even been able to sit up and hold their heads up yet. But that would have been a common thing to have done, because they introduced baby food so much earlier. You know, both of my babes naturally started eating. Mariam didn't eat till, you know, post her first birthday, and, you know, second babe as well, like, you know, late 8 months. But we're not looking at the factors as to why someone is going to, or why, sorry, a baby is ready for food. It's more like, we've got the marker now, let's get the food down the baby.
Just like, we've got the due date, let's get them induced.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It's God, this, just this time management and this obsession with numbers that we have, that we constantly project, whereas actually it's like, actually we're all sovereign individual beings. Why don't we just listen to our bodies, listen to our baby's cues and follow that? This magic thing where everyone is different. Let's just honor that.
Yeah, and some babies might be ready to eat six before some, you know, some will say, look, my baby was snatching my food and eating and chewing at, you know, five months or whatever. Now, yes, the recommendation is for 6 months. I'm not going to say you've done wrong, but, you know, it's just the recommendations are different to what they were. And that's the thing to keep in mind. And there are markers that we look at now as to how well baby is sitting up, or, you know, with assistance, or, you know, whether the baby can actually clear their airway if they start choking. And that's the most important thing, is looking at whether the baby is ready and whether their gut is ready, because that's something that we can't actually see. We can't see how well formed their digestive system is. And I don't think having a bit of extra breast milk is going to cause any problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I remember my health visitor telling me that, you know, and again, I don't want to think you're on all health visitors, some health visitors are amazing, but telling me that my first babe wouldn't learn how to chew if I didn't give her food quickly. What? And this was at the first year review. I was thinking, I'm fairly sure that I'm also a dentist from a previous life. I was like, I'm sure she's going to learn how to chew properly. As a dentist, I've never met anyone who doesn't know how to chew because they didn't eat food soon enough. But I didn't say that, I just thought it.
Well, oh my gosh, I don't even have the words for that. That's just absolutely ridiculous. Wow. It's so crazy. So what would you say to women who are listening to this that want to breastfeed, or maybe who are at the beginning of their breastfeeding journey, who are getting pressure or judgments projected onto them from family, friends, maybe not having a supportive partner? What would you say are things they could do to support themselves, or to, yeah, support themselves and continue the journey if they're choosing to do that?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked the question, because I realized I haven't talked about groups at all, which is just bonkers. So I've recently, this year I've been on mat leave, and I've been supporting our local group. So it's run with the council, but I started my own group in the last month, and it's been a really exciting thing to do, to sort of get going. But I would say, you know, I would say talk to people who have fed that you know. And if you don't know anyone who's fed, you're always welcome to call the National Breastfeeding Helpline for someone to talk to about, you know, that kind of thing. And you could do something like, so the Association of Breastfeeding Mothers, ABM, they have a course that you can do for free with your partner and with your family, whoever you want to do it with, and to give you a bit more information on what feeding is going to be like. there are lots of good books that you can have a look at. One that I know people really rave about, which is sort of it's called The Food of Love by Kate Evans. And it's quite a, like, you know, quite easy to access and, you know, to read book. And then if you wanted something that was a bit more researchy, there's always lots of stuff by Amy Brown, but that might make you feel a bit cross. There are really good things to, you know, to have a read. And then if you didn't want to necessarily read, I would say find your local group and go along. They are very happy to see, you don't have to have your baby to go along to a group. And, you know, it's great going along to a group because you're seeing other you know, other moms, other babes, and you can chat to the peers, ask all the questions that you want to ask. You can see feeding in action, and, you know, you can see how people are juggling it, you know, in the day-to-day life, and it can be done. You don't need to hide indoors. I feel like that's the one of a really common thing that people feel trapped because they think, okay, I've got to stay indoors now, I've got to buy certain clothes to feed, I've got to buy these certain gadgets, whether that's a pump or, you know, whatever it is to feed. And, you know, you don't need all of these things. You don't need lactation cookies, you don't need any, you know, you just need you, and you need, you know, how to have a look at some information on how, you know, basic stuff on how breastfeeding works so that you can give yourself the very, very best, you know, start and chance and have a look, because I think that there's so much concentration, rightfully so, on birth and how we're going to birth, but people don't necessarily think about that postpartum stage and how, let's say, how is feeding going to work, how, what will I do if I experience, you know, difficulties with feeding and I need, who am I going to call on for support to come round and cook me something so that I'm eating and sustaining myself, will I call, say, if I'm experiencing, you know, difficulties and pain, and I'm, you know, yes, you can call your local, you know, health visitor team, and sometimes it's great and they have infant feeding specialists on their, you know, via the NHS and you can contact them, but sometimes that is a referral away. And so, you know, having good links with your local group could be really helpful for that. And, you know, if you can afford, say, a IBCLC who's like a certified lactation consultant, you could always go down that route as well. But, you know, it always makes me feel so sad to even say that, because as much as it's great to have that option, you know, you have to pay for that option. But that could be something you could consider if, let's say, someone's asking you what you want for the baby. But like, you can pay for my IBCLC. I'm gonna get my first session booked in just in case I need it afterwards, you know, and have that on reserve just in case you need it to have a check-in, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as you say, there is so much focus on the birth. We don't speak enough about the postnatal, and, you know, then you're here and you've got this whole human being that you've made and birthed, and they're relying on you, and, you know, having to sustain yourself, as you say, and look after yourself as well as looking after them can be really overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So having that support in place before, and I know it's really common as well for women to, I guess, again, it's the number thing of how often is baby feeding, how often they should be feeding, should I be waking baby up every X amount of hours? Because, you know, I've heard midwives saying it to women before who have given birth, when I've been there and the midwives will come in for a check, and, you know, when I've been working as a doula, and they come in and say, oh, you know, how many times did baby feed last night? Are they feeding every 2 hours? Or, and then mum might go, oh gosh, no, I don't know, I didn't remember to check the time they fed. Or, you know, it can feel really overwhelming to then have to be timing yourself and your baby. Because for me, you know, I know there is an element of that's, you know, wanting baby to get enough sustenance and nutrition, but also our bodies aren't broken. Our babies are literally survival, is pure instinct. Feed, communicate, sleep, poo, wee, whatever. Mm. And to think that we have to override their natural instincts and wake them up to feed them, like they will let us know when they're hungry, is what I believe. But I would love to hear, yeah, that, like, your views on that, because I hear it so much, like, or new mothers being like, how often should I make sure baby's feeding? And it's like this added pressure. Of course we want to feed baby, yeah. We want them to be healthy, but it just feels so another thing for mothers to hold, rather than just being like, my baby's hungry now, I'm going to feed my baby. There's this pressure of having to make sure you're doing the right thing again.
Yeah, I think you really explain that, sort of like hit the nail on the head in terms of the timing. And I think that can be really difficult now, because everyone has these apps on their phone, and how long has baby fed for, and you know, that kind of thing. And really there can be an element of comparison then, especially when you get told, like, baby needs to be on each side for 20 minutes and that kind of thing. Yeah. Sometimes that prescriptiveness isn't very helpful, because all babies feed differently. Some are very effective feeders and might not need to feed for as long. And also we're thinking about all, you know, breasts have capacity to hold different amounts. And so, you know, sometimes some babies will need to feed a little bit more often and will be asking for milk more often. And some babies might be happy in between. I think the difficulty, I think where it comes from is a place of concern, where they want to, you know, babies be feeding regularly enough so that the breasts are stimulated and your supply is kept up. Okay. And I think, you know, that at the beginning, that can be quite crucial, you know, in the first however many weeks whilst your supply is stabilizing. But let's say a baby's weight is fine and their output is good, so they're peeing and pooing properly. We don't have to be obsessive about these things, you know. It's just that, you know, I would like to caveat it with, yes, those early weeks are quite important in terms of that. But, you know, for example, I compare my first and my second. I did it completely differently. And actually with my second, I'd done a lot more learning, because I had gone through and done doing my breastfeeding counselor training. And I was so worried that she just wasn't feeding enough. I was absolutely convinced that she wasn't on for long enough, but she slept a lot more and didn't feed for as long. And yeah. I feel like, you know, I felt like there must be a problem here, you know, what's the problem, and searching for the problem. And I guess that's what happens when you give prescriptive information out, that this is what should be happening for this amount of time. So that's, you know, I think where you can run into problems. But if you, you know, if you think that baby is healthy and output peeing and pooing as they should be, then, you know, there is, apart from they usually say you sort of like in the nighttime, I guess you can go for a little while longer, and in the daytime, usually 3 to 4 hours. And if baby is kept close with you and you're not separated from baby, then the likelihood of them feeding, you know, in those early stage, if you were in the early stages, if you were sort of relaxing in your bed or on the sofa and baby's on you, baby can smell you, baby's quite likely to latch on and ask for a feed. But whereas, you know, if you're, let's say, for example, everyone and their donkey has come around to see you on day two and day three, and you're like, oh,
going past the parcel.
Where is the baby? Oh, Uncle Jim is holding the baby over there. Like, you know, how am I going to get the baby back now? You know, if that's what's happening, then that's going to be quite difficult for you to feed the baby when the baby wants feeding.
Yeah, and to like establish breastfeeding and stuff, really, mm-hmm. because baby's cues aren't being heard, or baby, you know, I have heard people being like, oh, they were kind of looking around, or were doing hands to mouth and then couldn't smell mom and kind of just went back to sleep or whatever. And it's like, you know, they're little cues that we're missing when every Tom, Dick and Harry's holding the baby and getting a little oxytocin hit.
I know, and it's so hard, that one, because you're kind of saying to people who love you and you love them that, by the way, I don't want everyone to come round in the first half and think, what do you mean? You don't want us to see baby and things. But the thing is, in those early days and early weeks, no one else really needs to hold the baby apart from mama and primary care, you know, whoever's going to be the primary caregivers. And, you know, that's something to keep in mind, that, you know, when you're, Samsara mentioned this from Conscious Birthing, and she's just saying that, you know, when people are coming round to your house, I mean, what state are you in? You're not in oxytocin loved up state, as much as you have, you know, might love your mum or whoever coming round. I'm not saying you don't have them round, but it's just that you're downstairs, you most likely may not be in bed, you're in hostess mode, and you're like, well, what can I, do you need a tea or whatever it is? Or even think, worrying, for example, like, oh, the people have come round, haven't got any biscuits or whatever it is. And your mind shouldn't be there. Your mind should be in rest mode, and you should be, you know, if you want to, lying down and relaxing, and baby should be close by, and you should both just be chilling. And I guess I feel very strongly about that. I know not everybody does it that way, but I've, you know, it's hard to say that sometimes people, and communicate that without offense, but something to think about again during pregnancy. Plan for it.
And I always say, I remember Samsara saying, you know, when you have your baby, it should be 7 days in the bed, 7 days around the bed, and 7 days near the bed. And I'm like, yeah, if anyone's coming round, they should be bloody bringing a lasagna, staying only for 20 minutes, saying, you're amazing, do you want a cup of tea? and not asking to hold the baby unless it's offered to them, having a little look if they want to have a look. But, you know, inviting people into that space that you feel really safe with, that you don't mind lying in bed and being seen vulnerably and, you know, having a cry if you need to have a cry. And yeah, we shouldn't be opening the doors and letting our next door neighbours pop in. And, you know, it's like, it's been so normalised in our society, and that also goes alongside getting back in your size, whatever jeans, within a week, or bouncing back, or, oh yeah, I saw her at the gym a few days later. I'm like, get into bed, what are you doing? Yeah. Well, without coming from a place of judgment, because I know everyone feels differently and has a different journey, especially postnatally, but we really need to be talking about the support for mothers, because when mother and mom is okay, then baby is okay.
Yeah, it's the permission though, Beck, because it's kind of like you don't get given the permission to do that. And, you know, I'm sure no one from my family is going to be listening to the podcast, sorry Beck, but it's probably a good thing. I'm a bit too much already. But it's more that, you know, my husband was asked if I was depressed because I decided that I wanted to really honor the 40 days and, like, you know, take it really slow. And, you know, constantly, has she not gone out for a walk yet? Oh, I think she might be a bit depressed. And you're like, so that's where it goes to. If you want to take that time to relax with the baby and chill because you don't want to go out, you know, I had my second born in January, but, you know, the winter times. And you just, I don't want to be going out. I don't want to expose my breast out in, you know, the park. And it just,
I don't even want to be going out when I haven't just given birth in January, never mind when I've just had a baby.
Yeah, it just felt frustrating because you think this is why people feel they have to get out, because they feel that I have to put my face on, or I have to, you know, get dressed and go out. So I, you know, for some people that's what they need. They need to get out, get a walk, and to feel good, you know, get some fresh air. But for others, it can be like, you know, if I don't get, what might people think, or what might, so say if it's, I'm 4 weeks down the line and I'm still relaxing and I should be getting out to the XYZ baby yoga group and, you know, whatever. That kind of stuff really frustrates me. Everyone's journey is different. Some people need to go to a group a day and some people don't want to go to any groups, and that's okay. It doesn't mean that they're poorly socialized or whatever. They just want to relax. You know, that you
need to. There's no right or wrong. And like, yeah, we need to be normalizing both of the parts. And like, if you want to stay indoors with your baby for 40 days and don't see anyone, then you absolutely, we should be doing that. And we should be supporting mothers to do that if that's what they want to do. Not being like, have little tantrum because I'm not getting to see the baby. Like, absolutely not. You know, it's such a big thing. But having that time, that postnatal space protected, will support with breastfeeding. Of course it will. Yeah.
But, you know, even thinking back to postpartum time in terms of maternity services, so for example, oh, baby's a bit yellow, I'll come back tomorrow, go back tomorrow. Oh, baby needs this, I'll come back. Oh yeah, oh, we're not, she's not in today, the person that you need to see. So you need, so it felt like you're constantly leaving the house for the appointments. So even if you want to do the 40 days, you know, some areas are great and very, they get to have sort of home visits with midwife, but not all areas do that. So you're constantly leaving the house, and that's stress in itself, getting the things together to leave the house. And you've just had a baby and you just think, I don't want to leave the house. And I think it was small things like that which did make me feel like, why am I opting in for this postpartum whatever? I don't want to call it care without, you know, that might sound harsh, but it wasn't care, because you just feel like you're just going there to have a box ticked. And you think, oh, I just kind of just want to be at home. I don't want to be leaving the house and, in, you know, out in the open. And it, you feel vulnerable, like physically and, you know, emotionally, you just feel like you're in a very fragile state. You just, I felt that way. And I just wanted to be at home. I didn't want to have to go out to appointments.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So to wrap it up, I would love to know, if someone's listening to this and they're planning on breastfeeding, do you have any hints or tips or anything that you wish you'd known before you started breastfeeding?
I think what I'd say is that, aside from what I feel like we've been saying for quite a lot of the podcasts, that each journey is individual, it's also that you've got it in you to do it, for sure. And I know that's not a hint or a tip, because there are no hints and tips to like sort of in the sense of like you've got it within you to do it, mm-hmm. and you can do it, and it will be different week on week, and whatever it feels like in those first 6 weeks, 8 weeks, it will not feel like that 6-8 months down the line if you decide to continue for that long, you know. And it will be different, you know. Babes decide that sometimes they want to feed a lot and sometimes they want to feed less. So, you know, I would say just call in everyone that you can, that you know will, you know, be there to say, you're doing amazing. And I feel like that is probably the key. You want to have people around you who are going to sing your praises. And if that's at a group, it doesn't have to be family and friends. Not everyone has that. If it's at a group or wherever, hopefully you can seek those places out. And even if it's online, there are great communities online. That's quite a few, but there you go.
Amazing. No, thank you so much. And I would love for you to tell everyone where they can find you if someone wanted to get in touch with you or your services or what you offer.
Oh, so I'm listed on Doula UK. So I'm a birth and postpartum doula. And then I can provide remote support with, I guess, anything that you want birth and postpartum related. So I'm on Instagram and my name is Amana Doula. So AMANAH Doula. And then the other thing is you can find me at my group. So if you're in Bristol, our group runs in St. Anne's and I'd love to meet you. Please come down. So we're starting again in January. That'll be January the 2nd. And we run from 11 o'clock. So it'd be lovely to meet you there.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And I'll put the details of Hasra's information where you can find her in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on, Hasra, and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, Beck. Bye.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Why of the Womb podcast. If this episode resonated with you and if you enjoyed this episode, please take a screenshot and share this on your social media. Tag me at Beck Wallace Birthkeeper and drop me a message. Let me know how you found it. And if you feel called, please feel free to leave a review. It just helps other people to find the podcast so that we can build community and gather together. Thanks so much. Sending all the love.